Now she said, "Do something sexy over the phone." "I can't, Corey. I'm at work. There are people here." She felt the back of her neck prickle at the thought. In the distance, teenagers and parents with little kids were moving around the skate-fest rink. The sound was like an ocean, coming at her in scratchy waves as the skaters moved closer and then receded. She thought of Corey on top of her, his hands all over her, proprietary, welcome. Her arousal lifted her away from the smells of people's feet and the glass box of rotating, candied-looking hot dogs.
"You got something more important to do, Kadetsky?" he asked.
"Yes."
"What?"
"Rent skates to skinheads."
"Ah."
"I wish I could do it, though," she said sadly. "I really, really do."
"I know."
Sadness, excitement, then sadness again. It all rose and fell like the sounds of skaters scuffing the floor of the rink. "Hold tight," she thought, conveying this to both herself and Corey, thinking of them in bed together, and the joint effort couples had to make to be a couple and stay a couple. If one let go, then that was it. Both of them fell. "Hold tight," she thought, imagining his body and her own much smaller body against it. "You should go to sleep," Greer finally said. "It's late where you are."
"I have to look over my deck pages."
"I'm afraid I don't know what that means."
"I'm afraid I don't either, but I'm pretending I do. We're flying to Bangkok in the morning for a meeting. I miss you," he said again. "Imagine me in my douchey white shirt and tie."
"I bet you look hot," she said. "Imagine me in my orange skate-fest tunic and little cap." And so it went, conversations with Corey on a different continent, while Greer leaned across a sticky, shellacked skate rental counter. After work in the evening, she drove her parents' old Toyota home along the highway. Sometimes, on Woburn Road during that standstill summer, she would park the car and get out to talk to Corey's brother, Albie, who was now 8 years old and handsome, big-headed, and could often be found outside on his razor scooter, powering down the slant of the driveway. "Time me, Greer, while I go around the block," he said one evening when she came home from work in her parents' car. He'd been waiting for her, she realized, riding in circles until the car pulled onto the street. So she agreed to time him with the stopwatch that he held in his hand for just this purpose. "I want to beat my personal best," Albie said. "You know what that means, right? It's the best record a person has thus far."
"I can't believe you just said thus far. Well, actually, I can.
Miles Leggett told me that his dad calls me an idiot savant." "Well, then his dad has no idea what he's talking about." "Someday he'll know. Like when I win the Nobel Prize." She laughed. "Aim high. What field are you going to win it for?" "Oh," said Albie. "I didn't know you needed a field. Do I have to decide now?" Even as he said this, she knew she would recount the conversation to Corey tomorrow on Skype. "No," Greer said. "You definitely don't have to decide now." "Okay, go ahead. I'll time you." "Keep an eye on Slowey, too," said Albie. And then Greer saw that his turtle lay humped in the grass at the side of the driveway. "Ready?" Greer asked, and Albie nodded. "Get set," she said. She paused and watched him angle himself forward. "Go!" Greer lifted the start button as Albie headed down the driveway. Soon he was out of view. The front door of the Pinto's house opened, and Greer turned to see Benedita on the front step, looking for her son. There was always a stiffness between her and Greer. "I'm timing him, Mrs. Pinto," Greer explained. "He's going around the block on his razor." "All right," Corey's mother said, coming over to her. And the two women stood in silence, neither one moving, both of them short and as still as the turtle at their feet. They waited for Albie the way sailors' wives used to wait for their husbands to return from the sea. The silence seemed to go on for too long, and then, as if the sound barrier had suddenly been breached, there came a scrape of wheel on road, and they both looked up at the same time and saw Albie make the turn onto Woburn and head in their direction. Watching him approach, they both shifted into a state of unaccountable, shared happiness. Albie kicked his way back up the slanted drive and wound up at the feet of Greer and his mother. He was out of breath, his face hot, his narrow shoulders heaving. "Greer, what was my time? What was my time?" he asked her. At which point she realized that she had forgotten to stop the little silver stopwatch, which still beat on in the palm of her hand. One night, late that summer, when Greer was sitting in bed at her computer, an email popped into her inbox from an address that she didn't recognize. ff@scvc.com. She clicked it absently, assuming it was spam. Later she would say to Corey, "What if I had deleted it and never wrote back? It makes me ill to even think about." "Dear Greer Kadetsky, you wrote me a very kind note a couple of months ago at a low moment for me. I fear I didn't write back. My apologies. You can imagine the volume of notes I received. I'm reaching out personally to a small number of people as I put together a team for a grand new venture. And since you'd been interested in applying for a position at Bloomer, I wondered if you might be interested in coming in for an interview for this instead. It will be very different, though I'm afraid I must be slightly mysterious about it at the moment. Warmly, Faith Frank." Warmly. That was a new one to Greer. She had never seen anyone sign an email that way, and it seemed to her somehow not only adult, but also more than that. Rich, sophisticated, knowledgeable. She wanted to sign her own return email to Faith that way, too, but felt that it would be like a little girl trying on her mother's ball gown. Greer wrote a response quickly, a pulse tapping in her eyelid. "Dear Faith Frank, I was just sitting here checking email and suddenly you appeared. Different email address, same person. Of course, I am very interested in your grand new venture, despite the mysteriousness, or even because of it. Please let me know how to arrange an interview. Thank you so much for thinking of me. Sincerely, Greer Kadetsky." Then, it was even more shocking when Faith wrote back immediately. "Dear Greer, that's wonderful. My assistant, Ifat Khan, will be in touch with you in the morning. Warmly, Faith. P.S. Why are we both still awake? As my mother used to say, we should hit ourselves over the head with a frying pan to get to sleep." To which Greer replied, "Dear Faith, note to self, must buy frying pan. No chance of sleep now. Too excited about prospect of GNV, aka Grand New Venture. Good night, Greer." 3 days later, she was on the bus going back down to New York City. The address this time was a mirrored glass midtown skyscraper called the Strode Building. In the lobby, Greer was ID'd, and a terrible photo was taken of her in which she appeared to have a snout. Worse, she had to wear the photo as a badge and was sent through a turnstile that flung its jaws open to admit her, and then she shot up to 26, where the elevator opened onto a space so blank and white and expansive that she could not tell if it was still under construction or if this was the way it was permanently meant to look. It was like a floating space station, an empty field with a complicated geometry of cubicles hinted at in the remote distance, everything white, and no bold-faced institutional name hovering above the reception desk, so she still did not know exactly where she was. "I have an appointment with Faith Frank," she told the receptionist, with pleasurable but carefully modulated self-importance. The young woman nodded and spoke into a headset, and momentarily another young woman appeared, elegant, composed, a tiny stud in her nose the size of a seed. "I'm Ifat Khan," the second woman said, "Faith's assistant. It's great to meet you. Come on back. Faith's in with some people." Greer followed her down a white hallway that led like a tributary into a large white office. At a long white desk that was made from a repurposed door, a remnant of a building in which secret suffrage meetings had taken place long ago, she'd learn on her first day of work, sat Faith Frank, and around the room, standing and sitting, were several women of various ages and two men. Faith rose to greet her. Of course, she had grown a few years older since the night in the Ryland Chapel, and up close the change was slight but noticeable. She wore it well. Faith still was a person of gravitas and glamour, intelligence, cheekbones, warmth, greatness, all of which was once again exciting. Faith introduced her to everyone, but Greer could barely pay attention to the names, and soon these people stood and left, so it didn't really matter who they were. If she was hired, she would immediately learn their names.
"Did you get some sleep since I wrote you?" Faith asked.
"Yes, did you?"
"Not a whole hell of a lot."
"Well, then it's a good thing I brought you this," Greer said. She reached into her bag and with a flourish brought out the small frying pan she had bought at the Target near her parents' house and carried with her down to the city just in case it seemed appropriate to give it to Faith, which she figured it probably wouldn't. But now she was taking the risk. Faith looked surprised, but then she smiled. Suddenly, they had a private joke between them.
"Oh, that's a good one," said Faith. "Very funny. I'll definitely conk myself over the head with it when I can't sleep. And whenever I do that, Greer, I'll think of you."
She put the pan on a side table and said, "Let's get down to business before someone comes in with another emergency." They sat together on a white sofa that looked out on the skyline, the workday. It was impossible to look out on the city from high up without thinking for a second of 9/11, even 9 years later. Any overarching view of the city seemed to call for a brief, noble hush. Smokestacks steamed, lights stuttered, there was movement along the grid. The quiet moment now wasn't unpleasurable. It was just a moment of seriousness, born in something terrible, but now uncoupled from it. Faith took a pull on the mug of tea in front of her. Nearby were little tins of oolong and Earl Grey and jasmine. A tea ball lay on its side, with sprouts of used leaves poking through the holes like hair in old man nostrils. "After Bloomer closed," Faith began, "I was in a daze, maybe even a mild depression. I went up to my weekend house just to regroup, and one day I got a call from an old friend. We go back a number of decades, and our paths have been very different, to put it mildly. He's Emmett Schrader, the venture capitalist." She paused. "You do know who I'm talking about, right?" Greer nodded, but she wasn't completely sure. She knew who Emmett Schrader was, roughly, just as she had once known who Faith Frank was, a little less roughly, though she badly wished she could Google the venture capitalist and billionaire right now, as she had originally done with Faith, so she could be knowledgeable during this interview. "He said he wanted to make me an offer," Faith said. "I thought that meant he would buy Bloomer and it would have yet another life, straggling along. But he said no, sorry, it wasn't that. Bloomer was no longer viable in today's world."
"Not even the website?" asked Greer. "I mean, if you revamped it, obviously. No offense," she quickly added. "But I've wondered about that."
Faith shook her head.
"No. He said he admired our mission all those years, admired our determination, but that he has bigger plans. He told me he wants to bring some of the ideals of feminism out into the world in a new way. So, here's what's happening," Faith continued. "His firm is underwriting a women's foundation. What we're going to do, mainly, is connect speakers with audiences. We want to address the most urgent issues concerning women today. We'll have summits, talks, conferences. He's offering significant funding." She paused.
"I know we'll get criticism, Schrader being Schrader."
"Pardon?"
"Oh," said Faith, "he is who he is. He hasn't always put his money to good use. He's funded some pretty questionable ventures. You can read up on it. I have. It doesn't make me happy. But he has also frequently been heroic with his money, and he seems genuine in his desire to make this work. It's a risk, but he's promised to really go deep. Of course, that's not all of the criticism we'll get. There's also me."
Greer wanted to say, Who could criticize you? But she knew who could. She had seen them on blogs, and of course in the comments section of Femme Fatale.
I do what I can, said Faith. I do it for women. Not everyone agrees with the way I do it. Women in powerful positions are never safe from criticism. The kind of feminism I've practiced is one way to go about it. There are plenty of others, and that's great. There are impassioned and radical young women out there telling multiple stories. I applaud them. We need them. We need as many women fighting as possible. I learned early on from the wonderful Gloria Steinem that the world is big enough for different kinds of feminists to coexist, people who want to emphasize different aspects of the fight for equality. God knows the injustices are endless, and I am going to use whatever resources are at my disposal to fight in the way I know how.
As long as you keep wearing your boots, Greer impulsively put in. She remembered then that she had thought working at Femme Fatale would have been more exciting than working for Faith Frank, but she understood that it wasn't true.
Then Faith said, There's another aspect to the venture that I wanted to tell you about, Greer. And this was the reason I finally accepted the position after telling Emmett no.
She leaned in a little closer.
Here's the deal. Fairly often, she said, we'll actually be able to initiate a special emergency project that will make an immediate difference in some women's lives.
That sounds great, said Greer, though she couldn't imagine what any of this really meant, except in some blurry way that involved a line of strong women standing under a rain shower of funding. She wanted to be in that line. Despite often being so quiet and uneasy, she wanted to seem like an appropriate and inevitable choice. Greer Kadetsky, the young woman with the hot face, who works as fiercely as that hot face would suggest.
I will work so fucking hard for you, Faith Frank, she wished she could say.
We've already started doing this. I recently got Emmett to release funds to an organization focused on improving the health and well-being of women of color living in the rural South. By the way, we're calling ourselves LOCI, said Faith.
Excuse me? Said Greer.
I know, I had the same reaction, but it grows on you. LOCI, as in the plural of locus. Because there are so many issues to focus on concerning women, and so many places to put our energy. It's not the greatest name in the world, but we reached the deadline and didn't have anything better. People see the word on the page, spelled L-O-C-I, and they think, oh God, how am I supposed to pronounce this? Is it Loki, Loki, Loci? The dictionary gives you all three options. Me, I'm firmly in the Psi camp.
Then so am I, said Greer.
Emmett wants me to complete my team very quickly. I've already brought several people in, and they've started working. He rented this enormous space for us here. God, it's so different from what I'm used to. You saw the Bloomer office. I'm used to places where three people share a desk, and the elevator always breaks. That's what sisterhood means to me. But now we've hit the big time. Schrader Capital wants us close by, and they're right upstairs on 27. She glanced upward in illustration, then laced her hands and looked directly at Greer.
So, what do you think? She asked.
I think it sounds amazing.
It does, doesn't it? Does it fit into your master plan? Faith asked.
Not sure I have one.
Really? I thought everyone did at your age. Mine was to get as far away from my parents as I could.
Greer became self-conscious. I'd like to work here. That's my plan. And at night I'd like to do some writing. Maybe I could even become a writer someday, but for now I want a job that will kind of put me in the world, I guess, and help me make meaning. That's what you said when I met you. Anyway, I think this job could be that.
Faith nodded seriously.
Okay. I'll be blunt with you, Greer. I'm not interviewing you because of your brilliant intellect. I know you're smart. Your grades are great, and frankly, you're a good, instinctive writer, and I think you'll have some real luck with that. But you're, what, 22?
When I was 22, I knew nothing about anything, and I went skipping off into the world.
To be a cocktail waitress in Las Vegas, Greer said, remembering.
Yes, exactly. No, I'm interviewing you, primarily because I think you're promising. And hey, you also brought me a frying pan today, which was witty. So if you're willing, I'd like to bring you on board.
Oh, Faith, thank you, Greer said, flushing. I'm definitely willing.
The job will, of course, be entry level. Much of it will probably feel boring and repetitive.
I doubt that.
No, it's true. Hear me out. You'll be one of our bookers. Eventually, you'll be much more involved with a variety of things here. It's up to you how quickly that happens.
Greer could barely stay seated as Faith described the specifics of the job to her. She wanted to crouch down on the floor like a weightlifter and raise the long white length of sofa into the air with Faith Frank still on it, just to show her that she could.
2 weeks later, Z helped Greer move into a studio apartment in Prospect Heights, Brooklyn. She could never have lived in such a place by herself if Emmett Schrader hadn't been unusually generous with all salaries at Loci. The apartment was a simple, grimy box in a small building, and it needed a deep clean that neither Greer nor Z was willing to give it. But it also possessed original moldings and pressed tin ceilings, and the lease was hers. Through friends, Greer had found a bed, which had been placed in one part of the L-shaped studio. She also bought a compact little sofa, lightly used, that could open into a place to sleep if a friend stayed over, and this she wedged tightly into a corner across the room. The walls held only a few generic prints for now. There was a flower/vagina painted by Georgia O'Keeffe. Not the original, in case you were wondering, she'd said to Corey when she gave him a Skype home tour, carrying her laptop around the room. While Z assembled an IKEA chair for her, Greer continued the tour for Corey outside alone with her phone, providing audio narration, describing the farmer's market within walking distance, and Grand Army Plaza, and the park, and the Brooklyn Public Library, with its big gold doors. Nearby, she said, hulked the Brooklyn Museum and also the Botanic Garden, and along Washington and Franklin were Caribbean beef patty emporiums, not that I will ever set foot in them, but you will, soon enough, and check cashing stores and taxi dispatchers. Late that first afternoon, with the place unpacked and set up enough to be functional, Greer and Z sat on the front stoop. I love your street, Z kept saying as it got chilly out there.
Me too, Greer said, but it feels so strange.
She looked at Z. You okay up there in Scarsdale? Not too lonely?
I'll manage.
One nice thing is the refrigerator with the ice maker, and the heated toilet seats, and all that.
Come stay with me as much as you want, said Greer. Really, you can just show up. I'll give you a key.
Thanks. I really appreciate everything, Greer said. Today would have been so much harder, just getting set up. I mean, you are the best, Z. You always are. I just want to say that. She felt the potential for tears now, with a mixed cause. Friendship, fear.
It's nothing, said Z.
They sat together a little longer, neither of them wanting to end the day. Well, I should catch Metro North back, Z finally said. Judge Wendy says she's making a special lasagna tonight, and my presence at the table is requested. I'm sure you want to be alone here anyway.
Greer wanted to say, don't leave yet. She hadn't meant to live alone. She couldn't stop thinking that Corey was supposed to be there, the two of them setting up house in a sweet early-20s way that was so hopeful.
Z took off, and later that night, lonely but also excited, Greer brought in a boxed and bagged dinner from a place several blocks away called Yum Cottage Thai.
This will be my neighborhood place, she thought. And then she realized, I have a neighborhood place.
Greer stood over the small kitchen sink, eating vegetable pad thai with efficient, feral automaticity. She smacked her lips loudly just because she was alone and could,
and wiped orange oil and a trace of peanut dust from her face with the side of her arm. Later, when she was getting ready for bed, thumps and clicks emanated from the apartment upstairs, and a sound of something being dragged. She had no idea what any of those sounds were, but she imagined that if Corey lived with her, they would be discussing it right now. "It's like they're bowling up there," she would say to him, and together, in bed, they would fashion a scenario that involved the upstairs neighbors and their in-home bowling alley. "What's the name of their league?" she would ask him. Corey would come up with something quickly, like, "The Gentrificettes." And then, of course, Greer and Corey would make their own various private sounds. Work would start in 3 days. When she'd first gotten the job at Losai, he'd asked her, "Did you look into everything about Schrader Capital and Schrader himself?"
"To a certain extent," she said.
"You should read up. It's what anyone would do." She saw that a great deal had been published about Emmett Schrader. Some of it focused on morally problematic companies he'd been involved with, and some of it focused on his philanthropy. Because Greer knew nothing about venture capital, VC, people sometimes called it, or what the business dealings of a billionaire might be like, she couldn't make too much sense of it, except to understand that he had a mixed record, which didn't seem unusual. But Faith liked Schrader, and had described him as an old friend, and that was obviously significant. On the night before Greer's job was to begin, Z met her for a drink in Brooklyn. She too had work in the morning, having begun a paralegal job at the law firm of Shank DeVillers. They sat on unsteady stools drinking beers and crunching wasabi peas in the low, honeyed light. "So, it's all starting for you," said Z. "Remember this moment. Take a snapshot of it in your brain."
"What moment is that?"
"The moment before it all begins. The moment before you start, you know, your life."
"I don't know if it'll be my life. Maybe I won't even be good at it."
"You'll learn to be good. You're good at a lot of things, Greer. Writing, reading literature, love."
"That's a weird skill set to mention."
"You are amazingly competent," said Z. "You got hired by Faith fucking Frank's foundation. A peck of pickled peppers. I bow down before you."
"And I bow down before you," said Greer. "You got me to Faith Frank. You made me go to that lecture. I probably would have stayed in my dorm room with my note cards, and then none of this would be happening." She paused. "You get me to do a lot, or at least to think about things differently."
"Aw.
Anyway, we have Ryland College to thank for our friendship. We will leave them all our money."
"They aren't getting a cent," Z said. "When I see the alumni magazine, I'm like, really? Why would I want to read this? Stupidy stupid, class of 81, now works in strategic planning."
"Along with his wife, Sally Stupid," said Greer.
"But they could write about you in the class notes," Z said. "Greer Kadetsky, class of 2010, now works for Faith Frank."
"That does sound good," said Greer.
Then, suddenly realizing the conversation was only about her, she said,
"Things will fall into place for you too, Z. I'm sure they will."
"Listen," Z said, more quietly now. "I have something." She reached into her jacket pocket, and Greer imagined that she was going to take out a small, sentimental gift, beautifully wrapped. Inside would be some sort of amulet that Greer could carry or wear around her neck as she began her first real job. But Z had no gift box in her hand, no charm on a chain. Instead, she had an envelope. Was it an emotional letter about how much their friendship meant to her? That would be very touching. Women were allowed to tell each other what they felt without holding back. Women could now say, "I love you," without any hesitation or discomfort, or a sense that there were sexual overtones between them, even if one of them was gay.
"Oh," said Greer, reaching out to take it. "Thank you, Z."
"It's for Faith, actually." Now the letter was an uncertain object, something Greer wasn't sure she wanted. It was as if she'd been tricked, cleverly served a summons without knowing it.
"What do you mean?"
"Well," said Z, Last night in my bedroom in my parents' house, I stayed up really late and made one of those lists in my head that you're supposed to make so that you know what you should do with your life. That's what this is? A list? No, wait. Anyway, for this list, first you're supposed to think of the things you definitely don't want your life to include. And I realized how much I don't want to be a paralegal. It doesn't excite me. And I know how much I don't want to be a lawyer, at least not the corporate kind. I see these young associates, the ones who work really late and do corporate law, and they're on call like doctors, except their work isn't in the service of humanity, unless it's the pro bono stuff they're allowed to do once in a while. I mean, they're like the opposite of doctors without borders. Lawyers without souls, I think of them. But the firm gives them a great salary, and in the beginning, to excite them and kind of confuse them, they take them out to baseball games and dinner, and they give them tickets to see Cirque du Soleil, which, in my opinion, is a punishment, not a gift. All those people in tights with diamond shapes painted on their faces, is there anything worse than a harlequin? But it all takes too much away from you, and doesn't give you fortification, or a good feeling, or a sense that you're actually doing something decent during your 2 seconds on Earth. And you know what? I don't want it. So what do you want instead? Well, actually, I'd love to work for Faith Frank's foundation, too, Z said gently. If she'll hire me. Greer couldn't think of what to say, but she was shocked. Z traced her finger in worried little swirls on the bar. I know you're surprised that I'm suddenly saying this, because I've never said it before. My parents have really pushed me to do something that could be a career, but what you're doing, it actually could be a career. And I thought maybe I'd be an asset to Faith. I've been an activist, sort of. I always thought that in my fantasy I would work somewhere young and radical. This isn't that. But Faith has been this big figure in the feminist movement, and I think I could learn a lot from her. Anyway, it was just a thought. I see, said Greer blandly. I want to be able to come in and do something real, wherever I work. Something that I'm really energized about. Z's voice was getting a little thin and choked. My parents love being judges. They wake up in the morning and they're like, rah, rah, the sun is shining, let's go to our chambers, darling. And look how excited you are about starting your job. I want that feeling, too, said Z. I figure there are a lot of things to do at your foundation, and my parents would approve because it would actually be a normal job with a paycheck. I could just run around and do whatever Faith Frank needed. I could mill her tea leaves or something. Isn't that a thing? And maybe every once in a while she would impart some amazing piece of older woman wisdom and tell us stories from the past, and I'd happen to be in the room and get to hear it. And also, wouldn't it be a blast if you and I worked at the same place? Because you know how friends drift apart after college. Their lives become so different and they don't have a lot to talk about anymore. We could keep that from happening to us. Greer took a sip of beer and tried to keep her voice light and unalarmed as she said, So what did you write in the letter? Oh, you know, I explained to her who I am and why I want to be a part of what she's doing. I did the best I could. I warned her of my minimal writing skills. I reminded her that she met me the same night she met you, in the ladies' room at our college. And then I gave her the Z. Eisenstadt saga, the abridged version. Don't worry. I'm not worried, Greer said. The feeling of the night had shifted sharply, and Z apparently didn't even understand why. She was just sitting there in her usual, steady Z way, looking at Greer, waiting for encouragement. Instead, Greer wanted Z's letter to disappear, which of course it wouldn't, and she knew she would dutifully give it to Faith. Greer toyed with it now and leaned it against her beer bottle. The envelope was opaque, so she couldn't see what Z had written. She's your closest friend, Greer, Faith would say after she'd read it. What do you think? Should I bring her aboard? And Greer would say, Absolutely. The letter, slanted against brown glass, seemed to emit its own light.
Greer lifted her bottle, and the letter dropped onto the surface of the bar as if it had been felled.
So, Z said, what time do you have to be at work tomorrow?
Chapter 5. The light fixtures at the Loci Foundation had been outfitted with special energy-saving coils that were still in beta and were not quite bright enough for the tasks at hand, causing everyone who worked there to strain a little too hard, as though squinting over a medieval manuscript. Greer didn't mind. The pale, nearly celery-colored light over her cubicle up on the 26th floor burned with its low, unusual hue while she stayed extravagantly and almost piously late, though it took her too long to realize that her eagerness and effort might seem a little extreme. She worked with enthusiasm, but almost immediately she figured out the parameters of the job, and she understood that what she would be doing at Loci wasn't going to be intensely interesting. Faith had warned her of this during the interview, but it had seemed impossible. And the work wasn't boring, exactly. That was too harsh a description, because Greer was still in love with the idea of work. The term, the work world, seemed accurate. The office environment, like its own planet, made up of conference rooms and spring water dispensers and paper recycling bins. But the tasks of this job were mild, repetitive, and seemed removed from the large, grand venture of helping women. She could easily have been working in corporate party planning, she thought at some point late in her first morning there. At her desk, Greer was either on the phone or on the computer, hunting down yeses or maybes from potential speakers or their assistants or reps, and setting up travel plans, learning the abbreviations for the world's airports, some of which made no sense. Why was Newark EWR instead of, say, NWR, or even NWK? And why did Rome have to be the unmemorable FCO? Corey's brother Albie would probably know. This was the sort of information he liked to gather. During lunch break on Monday, someone passed around a takeout menu, and whoever wanted food circled their choice and cash was collected. Takeout on that day was from a Middle Eastern place, so Greer looked down the vegetarian column and ordered a falafel wrap. She thought that maybe they would all sit around together with their food, talking about the foundation and their desires and aspirations, but instead everyone just took their lunch back to their own cubicles. So Greer did too, eating in self-conscious aloneness at the space that she'd outfitted like a dorm room, with photos of Corey and Z and a good supply of Comcel Nutricol protein bars, the half-decent raspberry explosion and sand-dry double vanilla that her parents had offloaded to her. Corey texted Greer during that first day, asking for photos. She sent him pictures of the elevator and the little kitchen and a long shot taken across the entire floor, which included the backs of various people's heads. "Also, send anecdotes from your life," he said. "Remember, I work in consulting, so I'm pretty bored." But so far she felt removed from anything of significance. She had the sense that soon, much too soon, she would want to do more here. Other people at Loci were clearly already doing a great deal more. While she and the other booker, a shaved-headed gay man named Tad LaMonica, were left out of the daily meetings, she often glanced over into the glassed-in conference room. Faith could be seen sitting at the head of the table. Also in the room were the three researchers, Marcella Boxman, a sexy 23-year-old polyglot, Helen Brand, stylish, 35, a former union organizer and the only African-American on Faith's team, and Ben Prochnauer, good-looking, resolute-jawed, 5 years out of Stanford and most recently part of an anti-hunger startup, as well as Bonnie Dempster and Evelyn Pangborn, who were firmly old-guard second waivers, both in their 60s. Bonnie was a lesbian who still wore what used to be called, rudely, a jufro, and candelabra-like earrings that she made herself out of scrap metal. Evelyn was patrician and wry and dressed in a good wool suit. Both of them had been with Faith since the start of Bloomer. On the third day, in the middle of the meeting, Greer heard raised voices coming from the conference room. She looked over and could see an arm gesticulating behind the glass. It was Faith's arm, recognizable even from across the floor. And there was Faith's voice, too, though it had a strain to it. Greer heard her say, "No, actually, that is not what I meant. Let's start again. Marcella, go!" This was followed by Marcella Boxman's voice, going, speaking carefully as if to disguise fear. Then there was another remark from a still irritated Faith, and then someone else cautiously defended Marcella until finally the meeting was flowing the way Faith wanted it to. And Faith, mollified, could finally be heard saying, "Nailed it!" And everyone laughed a little too hard in relief. When the greenish glass door finally slid open with its shush sound, they all looked merry and satisfied, even Marcella. In fact, Faith had her arm around Marcella, as if reassuring her that everything was fine, the bad moment had passed, and it didn't matter anymore. Faith could grow impatient and angry, as she had been described, but most of the time she was easygoing and generous, particularly to her assistant, Ifat, and the rest of the support staff. Greer had already seen her speak kindly to the old custodian who emptied her trash, even though he had accidentally thrown away a diploma from a college in Minnesota that had given her an honorary degree. Faith was one of those people, Greer had started to see, who was seductive to almost everyone. Seduction was a power move to Faith, and maybe even a compulsion, but it seemed to happen effortlessly and was in the service of a greater good. She wasn't a firebrand or a visionary. Her talent was different. She could sift and distill ideas and present them in a way that made other people want to hear them. She was special. But still, apparently no one knew much about Faith's private life. Even her backstory. There had been plenty of interviews, but she remained a combination of warmth and mystery, and perhaps she liked it that way. To keep people from the particulars of your life kept you from being seen as one thing or another, and so it was possible you could be thought of as anything, or even as everything. They all wanted to know her. Greer sensed this as a secret, quietly present, all-office wish. Greer knew that Faith had been widowed long ago and had a grown son, but that was about it. Did she have a boyfriend? What a ludicrous word to use when describing her. She was far beyond boyfriends. She would tower over them, dwarf them. And she had mentioned that she had a weekend house. What did it look like? Was it gabled? And what were gables? And what about her apartment on Riverside Drive? Only her assistant, Ifat, had ever been there. And as if knowing Faith wouldn't want her to say anything about it, Ifat had never described it to anyone. When Faith approached Greer's cubicle the afternoon after the tense meeting and said, "Hey, stop by today, okay?" Greer became anxious, worrying that she had made a mistake and was going to be called out on it. It was awful to displease Faith, and wonderful to please her. The equation was absolute, as Professor Malik might have said. No one ever forgot the way it felt to be on the receiving end of Faith Frank's pleasure or displeasure. But Faith was smiling now. When Greer came into her office, she brought with her the letter from Z tucked into a folder. She'd dutifully carried it to work since Monday, waiting for a good time to give it to her. At first, though, it had seemed too soon and too nervy to assume that she could try to have a friend hired. But Z was waiting to hear what happened, so maybe this would be an okay time to try. In Faith's enormous office, they sat on either end of the long white couch. The light was slanting in, falling on Faith's cheek and revealing the faintest, nearly invisible layer of down that could only be seen from this exact angle, not that Greer would ever tell anyone she'd seen it. Faith leaned forward with her good, distinctive smell. Cherche was the name of the scent, Greer had overheard her say to Marcella, who was herself so stylish that she would soon, no doubt, be marinated in Cherche, too. "Tell me your impressions about what we're doing here," Faith said. "Be honest. Don't worry about my ego. I'm curious how it seems to you so far. The grand new venture. Is it actually grand?"
"At this point, maybe it's a baby grand." Faith smiled at her, and it wasn't even funny.
But it was in the neighborhood of funny, and Greer followed it up immediately by offering a variety of suggestions, all very different, so that Faith couldn't hate all of them. She had a suggestion about switching the order of two of the proposed events at the first summit, which was to be in March, on the theme of power. Without changing her tone, Greer lightly moved to another idea. "And I was thinking maybe we could look at some of the newer feminist blogs and see what they're up to." As soon as she said it, she thought about how the writers there sometimes took swipes at Faith. "The author of The Female Persuasion tries to persuade us that being in bed with Schrader Capital is perfectly fine. Corporate feminism much, Faith Frank?" Faith just nodded at Greer. "Sure, we can have a look," she said. "You know, though, I was brought in to do the things I know how to do." Greer, like all the other people Faith hired, knew there was a difference between working for Faith and working for a radical organization. But they all loved being led by this strong, appealing, dignified older feminist, and they loved what she stood for. When the conversation was almost over, everything had gone so well that Greer didn't want to ruin it with the clumsy intrusion of Z's letter, so she still chose not to mention it. Soon she would bring it up, she told herself. Soon. But walking back down the hall, feeling almost jaunty now, jig territory, Greer understood that she really didn't want to give Z's letter to Faith. She didn't want to share Faith with Z. She was still trying to figure out her place here at Loci, where she fit, where she didn't. Of course, she would certainly give the letter to Faith tomorrow, but she would do it only out of obligation. By Friday afternoon, Greer hadn't yet found the right time to give the letter to Faith. She realized now that she wasn't going to give her the letter after all. At around 5:30, still at her desk, Greer was surprised to hear voices gathering in the distance. "Get your jacket, Boxman," someone called. It was Ben. Men often seemed to call women by their last names when they were flirting. "That's Box Woman to you, Prochnauer," said Marcella, playing along. "Did someone reserve a table?" asked a voice that was familiar but not quite placeable, and then Greer recognized it as belonging to Kim Russo, the COO's assistant from up on 27. They'd met briefly when Greer got the Schrader Capital tour earlier in the week. "I did," said Bonnie Dempster distinctly. "The back one, in case we're too loud." "Oh, we're definitely too loud," said someone else, Evelyn maybe. "They have the best dirty martinis, olive juice." "Olive juice what?" said Ben. "Olive juice are circumcised?" "No, actually, they are not," said Tad, "and I happen to know."
"She said olive juice," Marcella said, and then there was unstoppered group laughter, and the elevator arrived with its pointed ping, and the voices faded as the whole group was swept downstairs together. They were going to a bar, and Greer had not been invited. Suddenly, she lost the easy pleasure of sitting there working late. She had already gotten used to the idea that she wasn't going to be invited into certain meetings, but Tad wasn't either, and Faith had made it clear it wasn't personal. Yet Tad was with the rest of them now, and no one had invited Greer to come along. It was perfectly still in the office now. It occurred to Greer, as if it were a revelation, that she was lonely there, something she hadn't exactly noticed before. Now it seemed so obvious. Across the big space, evening began to color the windows. Greer sat unmoving and suddenly vulnerable, and soon she heard a sound in the distance. Footsteps. Maybe it was a straggler heading off to the bar with the others. The steps were heavy and male. Then there was whistling. Greer sat and listened. "Strangers in the night," she decided after a moment. The steps came close, then stopped. Greer looked up and was shocked to see Emmett Schrader peering down at her. She had met him only once, on Tuesday morning, when he had come down to the 26th floor for an awkward meet-and-greet with the Loci staff.
He had walked into the larger of the two conference rooms with his young assistants dancing around him like sprites, and an older assistant, homely and probably long-suffering, slightly behind him. Schrader was 70, lion-headed, with longish silver hair, and that morning a dark, sleek suit and expensive tie.
"Hello, hello," he'd said to everyone with forced conviviality, and they'd introduced themselves to him one by one, including the support staff. But by the time they were halfway done, you could see he couldn't bear to be detained any longer, and that he was desperate to bolt. As a result, they all began saying their names at nervous, faster and faster clips, and soon they were through with the exercise and he was gone. Tonight, he was in shirt sleeves, released from his suit and tie, but there was something slightly alarming about the sight of an important man in a moment of repose. Anything could happen.
"Which one are you?"
he asked, actually entering Greer's cubicle.
"Greer Kadetsky," she said.
She looked around frantically at the trappings of her own little space. Her cheap plastic Goody hairbrush was on the desk. She'd used it earlier, and now she could see a few hairs flowing from it. She took in the scent of this very rich man and realized it was unambiguously exciting, or at least exotic, because it had nothing to do with men her own age, those hipsters or little boys who all smelled of smoke and cheese fries and Starbursts and macchiatos. Corey often smelled of the protein bars she gave him by the case, and a cheap shampoo he grabbed from the drugstore that was supposedly made with balsam, but to which he paid so little attention that he once referred to it as my balsa wood shampoo. She'd said, "You think you're shampooing your hair with balsa wood? Like, what kites are made of?" He had shrugged and said he hadn't ever thought about it. But someone gave a lot of thought to the way Emmett Schrader smelled and dressed and presented himself. He had a look and smell of holdings and real estate and absolute certainty. In such close proximity to him, Greer felt she desperately needed to hide her ratty hairbrush.
"So, what do you do here?"
Emmett Schrader asked, actually seeming curious.
"Booking."
"What does that mean? You pick the speakers to tell their sob stories?"
"No, I just try to get them to come. Other people pick them."
"Sounds fascinating. Why are you here so late?"
"You're here late, too," she pointed out.
"I have an excuse," he said. "I was hanging out with your boss lady. She and I have a two-person soiree once in a while. If I didn't get a chance to sit and talk with her after hours, then I don't know what I'd do. I need that."
"She's wonderful," said Greer spontaneously, and her voice came out sounding so reverent that Schrader laughed.
"She is," he agreed.
He looked at her with a thoughtful new expression.
"You're a Faith Frank groupie, is that right?"
he asked. Greer hesitated uncomfortably.
"Well, I don't know about that. I admire what she does."
"Oh, come on, tell me. You look up to her, right? You think she can do no wrong. You want to please her and all that crapperoo."
"Okay, sure. But I really do admire what she does."
"Well, me too," Schrader said.
They were quiet and companionable for a moment. He reached down onto her desk and spun her hairbrush, probably because he just needed to do something with his hands. Greer had read that the founder of Schrader Capital was restless, often bored, with an extremely short attention span. Many years later, after Greer was well known, someone at a dinner party in L.A. would ask her if she could name a quality common to successful women, and she thought about this for a second, then said, "I think a lot of them know how to talk to men who have ADD. Everyone at the table had thought this was a very funny answer, but maybe it was actually true.
"So," Schrader said, "you don't like to go out with all the other people at the end of the week? Out for potato skins and the blooming onion or whatever they eat to absorb all the alcohol?"
"No one invited me."
She heard the self-pitying sound to her words.
"No one had to invite you," Emmett said.
"Come." He gestured for her to follow him,
So she did, confused and cautious, walking behind him along the floor and down the hall and into Losai's communal kitchen. There, above the coffee machine, was a handwritten and prominent sign. "Friday drinks," it read, followed by when and where to meet. Somehow, in her absorption, she hadn't seen it.
"Friday afternoons are a thing," said Emmett. "Everyone goes out. The people from my floor and yours."
She understood that she had been doing everything wrong there, except for the work itself.
"You can still catch up with them," Schrader said.
So Greer went back to her cubicle and pulled her jacket from its hook. Then she hurried down the street to the old brown facade of the woodshed with the leaded glass windows, and there they were in the back, most of the team from 26, as well as some young associates and administrators from 27. When Greer walked through the hot, full bar and arrived at the pushed-together tables, Helen Brand raised a hand in greeting and said, "Everyone, make room!" They all rearranged themselves, opening up a space for her, and she slipped in between Ben and Kim Russo from upstairs.
"Howdy," said Kim.
She raised a glass to Greer.
"A Cosmo, so dated, I know," she said. "But I need something at the end of another rat-fuck week," and drank.
"Let's get you something strong, too," she said.
"Sure, though I'm not sure I need something strong. My job isn't too stressful. I actually wish it was."
"Did you hear that?" Kim said to the table. "Her job isn't too stressful, but she wishes it was."
"You'll get there, Greer," said Helen from down at the other end.
"I came on only 2 weeks before you did. It accelerated quickly."
"Well, your job is different. You have more to do."
"If you want more to do," said Kim, "then do more. That's the rule of thumb in any workplace."
"Good to know," said Greer.
"Make yourself indispensable. I somehow made the COO think I had a deeper skill set than anyone else, and he bought it. Now he calls me on weekends to do extra work, and I can't be like, 'No, thank you, Doug. I'd rather not.' Anyway, I got a bonus this year."
"There are no bonuses at a women's foundation," said Helen, "but I knew that going in."
"The bonus," said Ben, "is when Faith smiles at you. Then it's like being smiled at by God."
Greer took a sip of the cold drink that had appeared before her and said, "I would like to be smiled at by God."
"If God is actually a man, maybe you'll be winked at," said Kim.
"Or murdered," said Marcella.
"Seriously, why do men hate women? There are so many words in the English language that men use to describe their hatred of women. Bitch, whore, the C-word. It's like the overused thing about Eskimos and snow. But we never discuss this, the actual why of it. Ben and Tad, I'm looking at you."
"Come on, Marcella, I don't hate women," said Ben, holding up his hands. "Don't look at me."
"And don't look at me either," said Tad. "Most of the time I'm like, why do I have to share a gender with you, you piece of shit? It's like when you have a bad relative who has the same last name."
"Faith said men are scared of women," said Bonnie, "and that's the key to everything."
"Right," said Evelyn, "and she said it once on TV with that asshole novelist, back in 70-whatever.
"Evelyn and I were both in the studio audience," said Bonnie, "and afterward we all went out for fondue. Most of you won't know what I'm talking about, but it was the age of fondue."
"There were used skewers wherever you looked," said Evelyn. "I can't remember exactly what she said men were scared of."
"Whatever it was," Ben said, "I'm sure she was right. Men know that women have our number. Like, women can see through us."
"Yes, you had a hamburger for lunch," said Bonnie to laughter.
"And they can tell that we're full of shit. But the world keeps propping us up and women know it. And we know you know it. So maybe we hate you because you have something on us. You're basically witnesses to a crime."
Greer, listening, thought about how she wished Z were part of this. Then she remembered why Z wasn't, and felt a new, strange peppering of shame. She also thought about how Ben was like a young feminist's dream, so good-looking and on the side of women, not threatened by them at all. Corey could be described that way,